Godard Reel number 7. Perhaps you could carry on by telling me a bit more wherein you think that the training you had as an airship pilot may have perhaps had some deficiencies.
Well, I did think that more could have been done in the way of installing dual control in an instructional type airship. But as a matter of fact, you must remember there was urgency to get these operational ships out, and there was no energy was given or no time was given to preparing ships for deliberate slow time instruction. We felt, as young naval officers, that we had all the experience we needed in the handling of ships, and an airship was very much like a surface ship. Coming alongside a landing party in the air in the vertical plane was very similar to coming alongside a jetty in the horizontal plane, and the throwing out of ropes and the tethering of the ship and the handling of her and so forth wasn't so very different. The major difference was that the airship had to be kept in shape by being, as it were, kept up to pressure. That was a difference.
Were there any other points apart from that of dual control where there may perhaps have been some inadequacies?
Well, of course, we were used to shouting at each other on board ship, and the use of voice pipes was something that we didn't use more than we absolutely had to, and if you could make yourself heard by shouting, that was seemed to be all right. But I do remember that we did have voice pipes in my SS ship, and so that was an adjunct.
Were they a standard part of the equipage or something you installed yourself as a modification?
I think that we installed our own. I think that the first ones I flew in didn't have that. We depended on shouting and throttling the engine back if the chap didn't hear and talking to him. It, as you know, that the airship would continue to fly or to be stay in the air whether the engine was running or not.
Could we move on to the... Sorry, were you going to add something?
Well... No, I was going to, I think I've, the other part, you may say that I didn't have any real air experience of flying airships before I took over my own ship operationally at Capel, but you must remember that I had for the past, 6 or 7 or 8 months, been with airships, talking airships, seeing airships being flown, being members of the landing party, doing all kinds of things to do with the flying of airships, and in fact being a passenger in an airship doing practice, dropping of bombs and that sort of thing. And the consequence was I had been exposed to a great deal of it, and I was quite competent, really, to take on as an operational pilot, even although in those days we didn't wear wings on our breast and feel frightfully proud of having passed a lot of tests.
Can we move on to the actual flying of the SS airships? I'd be interested to know exactly what the respective roles of the two-man crew were in the course of normal operational flying.
Well, the pilot, and he liked to be dignified by the name of captain of the aircraft, was a midshipman or a sub-lieutenant in those days. And his wireless operator, who was the only other member of the crew, was really also an observer. Not trained much in observing, but he was trained as a radio operator to transmit any messages he was given by the captain. But he was also a man of common sense, and he could report what he could see, and he was expected to keep his eyes skinned and report what he saw on the surface and to assist in spotting submarines, which was our main function. Otherwise, there was no particular duty assigned to the operator, the wireless operator. But in fact, he was of great use when, as frequently happened, as much too often happened, the engine would stop mainly through overheating or through some technical defect. And we would then have to start it up again in the air, and we would have no means of starting the aeroplane except by getting out onto the skid and holding on with the right hand to one of the engine bearers or to some part of the aircraft, and swinging the propeller with your left hand to start up the engine again. And
could you tell me what the physical comforts and the equipage were like for both the captain and his wireless operator? Or did you call him an observer?
No, we called him a wireless operator.
Mm-hmm.
The aircraft was, I mean, the body of the car of my airship was nothing other than a BE-2C fuselage.
Yes.
With two seats in tandem, one behind the other. And in my seat, which was the back one, I would have an instrument board, very like, in fact, just the same as an airplane instrument board in some respects, except the instruments were different. I would have an altimeter, which is common to both. I would have a stethoscope, that's what it was called, which was a thing by which measured the pressure of the atmosphere more sensitively than did the aneroid. The thing about this was you had a tube which you pressed to close it off so that the pressure remained the same on one side of a U-tube, whereas the other side of this U-tube was open to the atmosphere, and in the U of the U-tube was a column of water. And if you were going up, then the pressure in your pinched side of the tube would remain what it was, and the pressure on the other side would be declining, would be getting less, and consequently the liquid would move round and you would see that you were making an ascent.
Mm.
And similarly the other way around for going down, that's the stethoscope.
Mm.
Then you had you had a pressure indicator to show you the pressure of the atmosphere, or the pressure of the gas inside the gas bag, which was kept what it should be by pumping in air or letting
yes.
out air, which I've described already. And then you had your physical controls, where you had a foot bar, like an aeroplane, in fact just the same as an aeroplane, connected to wires which went to your rudder right aft, and you steered by pushing your foot over. The difference in there was that we used to steer to the right. We would push our left foot right forward as though it was a tiller, whereas in an aeroplane it goes the other way. And for going up or down, you would depress or raise your elevator flaps.
And those were hand controls, right?
That would be done by a wheel, which was in the vertical plane in front of you, and you'd either wind that wheel up or wind it down. And that was rather a nuisance in a way, because it tended to get in the way of the little chart board which one had for holding one's map, if you rigged that up yourself. I rigged my own up. I didn't think it was fitted in the aeroplane, so that you could keep your chart in front of you and do your navigating with the aid of the usual instruments on a small scale.
Mm.
I don't remember having... Oh, yes, there was another control, two or three other controls. An essential one was to be able to open and shut your forward and after, as we call them, crab pots. They were sleeves of fabric inside a fabric's major sleeve to allow the air which went up through the duct pipe behind the propeller, which drove the air into either the forward ballonet or the after ballonet, and those you operated with cords, which were hooked into the fuselage. And then you had two valves. You had a gas valve down below, which was an automatic safety valve, which blew off when the thing came up to pressure. That you could also open by hand. And a top valve, the top of the ship, which also had a string. So you had strings to those valves. And then the only other strings that I remember having were... the controls for the water ballast.
Mm-hmm.
You could release so much water ballast, and it was left to us to devise our own means for perfecting, if one wanted to let so much go and not know more than so much, you could devise your own means for doing that. There was one other point I must mention, and that was, I hadn't mentioned how you measured your forward speed. That was done by a pitot tube, just the same as you have in an aeroplane, but the difficulty was to get it sufficiently far away from the body of the machine not to get interference. And I, for greater accuracy of navigation, rigged my pitot tube on an arm that I could lower down vertically to put it well below the body of the aeroplane, and so I felt I could get a much more accurate representation of the speed.
How comfortable were these airships for the captain and the operator?
Oh, well, you sat in aeroplane seats, and they were padded, and you used to... it was jolly cold. One used to get awfully cold after a while, but then one was wrapped up in flying kit and flying trousers and... one would wear long pants and that sort of thing. But we didn't have any heating arrangements. It was open, in the open air. We were head and shoulders out in the open air. And, of course, when I came to teaching other people to fly, I did put a rigger seat up, a pilot seat, on the back of the thing ride it as though it was a horse sitting up behind the pilot in the pilot seat, so that I really could watch what he was doing and tell him in his own ear to do something otherwise than he was doing it.
Now, the routine work at Capel was submarine patrols. Tell me about that routine. What did it involve exactly?
Well, I'm not certain that there was a very strategic plan about this, nor was there any very great knowledge about the pattern in which the German submarines operated. But you can understand that at the narrowest part of the Straits of Dover, there were nets put across and channels through which the steamships and trading vessels and naval vessels, for that matter, used to move through these nets through what were called gates. The nets could be pulled away to the sides, and I think those nets were constructed very soon after I got there, or just before. I can't remember whether I first did my flying without there being any nets. And then, of course, there were minefields, and we knew the positions of those minefields. And we presumed that the Germans would know the positions of those minefields because, to some extent, they were advertised so that our shipping wouldn't get entangled in them. Shipping was therefore conformed to certain lanes of approach. But we did know, of course, that submarines of fairly shallow draft could get above the levels in which they were likely to get entangled in the mines. And so they could approach at night from various directions. However, we had areas that we were given to patrol.
What was your area?
Well, it varied. There were about five areas which were marked on the map, and sometimes we would patrol one and sometimes another, and one airship would be allocated to one and one to another. But the principal traffic going across the waters were supply ships and leave ships, not major trooping forces, but there was a continual cross-channel steamer service of the kind that you ordinarily see, but they were turned into troop ships carrying men coming home from leave or going away on leave.
Could you describe for me what the typical routine would be for you at the time?
Well, one would be detailed for a patrol in the morning or the afternoon, and of course it might turn out the weather was bad for it, but normally we were rather expected to go on 8-hour patrols, which was a fairly long time, but if the weather was likely to be bad, we might be given a 4-hour patrol or a 2-hour patrol, and that meant crossing over the channel perhaps several times, or just going to a patrol area and going round and round in that area. One would take up one's lunch or some sandwiches or something to sustain you. I think probably a thermos flask or two, and you would ensure that your wireless operator has his food with him. And you would just set a course, and having calculated the wind and that sort of thing, you would steer off this. The visibility might be pretty poor. We flew in various kinds of visibility, and sometimes you wouldn't know for certain where you were at all because nothing whatever would be in sight. And it would seem to be a pretty dull operation on the whole. We never saw a submarine except sometimes our own in areas that were described to us beforehand where we would be likely to see our own. We used to see quite a lot of shipping, and I used to take note of this, but we had very loose instructions. All we were there to do was to attack submarines, but in fact I knew, and everybody else in the know also knew, that we could not attack a submarine. We could only report its presence and its course, and that was what we were there to do.
Was there a drill laid down for the eventuality, however unlikely it was, of your actually sighting a sub?
Oh, well, I don't think it was really, it could be called a drill. We were, had to use our common sense. We would have to make sure that it was a submarine we were looking at and immediately report that we thought we'd sighted a submarine, and then probably confirm it and give its course and its estimated speed, and then shadow it until destroyers should arrive to attack it with depth charges. But in fact, of course, it would see us long before we would see it, and it was pretty safe to assume that a submarine would submerge when it saw an airship long before the airship would see it. So on the whole, we didn't see airships, and our interests, we didn't see submarines, and our interests were largely to do with the shipping we were protecting, or with our own navigation, or with the